The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Liver Diseases is presented by Dr. Lindsay Moorhart.
So alcoholic liver disease, risk factors, obviously the amount of alcohol consumed, the duration of alcohol consumption, gender, viral hepatitis status, nutrition, iron overload, and genetics. So you're going to see alcoholic hepatitis. We see this frequently doing inpatient medicine. These people come in, they look like a highlighter marker. They're typically malnourished patients, frequently precipitated by a period of binge drinking. It might not be the day before. You can have a prodrome of 2 to 3 weeks. These people usually don't feel well. There's anorexia, they're nauseous, they feel fatigued, they're having weight loss. Persistence of alcoholic hepatitis is associated with a relentless progression to cirrhosis over months to years. So these people that don't stop drinking, they're at a higher risk for progression to cirrhosis. The complications with an acute episode of alcoholic pancreatitis can be similar to those you see in cirrhosis. So you might see someone come in that's young, they have alcoholic hepatitis, they have ascites, they're encephalopathic, but they may not actually have cirrhosis. This can be resolved once they abstain from alcohol and are further away from the acute episode. But some of the poor prognostic signs, advanced age, how jaundiced they are, azotemia, coagulopathy. So when these people come in, they're going to have hepatomegaly, maybe a mild fever. They're obviously going to be jaundiced. People can have some abdominal pain from the hepatomegaly. Again, just like I said, in more severe cases, these people might be encephalopathic, have ascites. When you're looking at their labs, they're going to have increased AST to ALT ratio as well. More than 10 times normal is not most likely related to an alcoholic hepatitis, but the ratio you're going to see is usually 2 to 3 to 1 with the AST to ALT. These people are going to have a decreased albumin, not necessarily because they're cirrhotic, but because they're maybe malnourished because their calories are coming from alcohol and they're not taking care of themselves. Prolonged PT, elevated bili. So treatment in general, long-term, is abstinence. One of my partners always likes to come in and tell people that they're allergic to alcohol. Bed rest, nutrition, plus or minus steroids. I'll talk about that in a minute. So what's most commonly used to assess the prognosis of a patient with alcoholic hepatitis? That's the discriminant function. So to calculate this, you can see the formula there. I have the calculator on. I think Hippocrates has one. A lot of them have it. When you see a discriminant function greater than 32, that effectively identifies patients whose risk of death is higher than 50%. This is when you consider steroids. This is really dependent probably on your where you're working. I know the centers around us don't usually routinely. Contraindications to steroids, though, if they have an acute infection, a psychosis, diabetes, renal failure. So there's definitely some contraindications that you need to be aware of. So non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So these people, they're not big drinkers, maybe less than 20 grams of alcohol a day. Just so you know, the drink that's considered one drink is 14 grams of alcohol. How many people are having a drink that's 14 grams of alcohol? Probably not many. It's usually, people say they have one glass of something and the glass is the size of the bottle. So exclusion of viral and autoimmune hepatitis, genetic and drug-induced liver diseases, you have to exclude these prior to saying that someone has NASH or fatty liver. So NASH, this is when fatty liver kind of turns into a chronic inflammatory condition. And again, they may have some small alcohol history, but usually it's not a significant one. So when you're looking at these people, they're going to have steatosis, hepatocellular necrosis, and inflammation on biopsy. This is just a picture of the liver. You can see the fat around it, but fatty liver, there's fat deposited into the liver, into the hepatocytes, and that's causing the inflammation. It's not just the belly fat around it. So these people are going to be people with central obesity, the apple versus the pear shape. For a male, it's 40 inches. Women, 34.5 inches. They may be a diabetic, may have hyperlipidemia. A lot of these patients are asymptomatic. They are coming in and getting a routine physical, and you notice that they have some elevated liver enzymes. They may complain of some right upper quadrant discomfort. That'd be if they have some pretty good hepatomegaly from the fat, maybe some malaise or fatigue. 75% of patients will have hepatomegaly, so we get a lot of consults in the office for hepatomegaly that turns out to just be from fatty liver. So you're going to see that the aminotransferases are elevated, but they usually should not be more than 300. The AST to ALT ratio here is less than 1. So if you're looking for alcoholic liver disease, the AST to ALT ratio is going to be greater than 2 to 1. And you might also see an elevation of the alkaline phosphatase and the GGT. So on imaging studies, you'll see a lot of ultrasounds that come back. They say fatty liver. Fat's bright on this. You need to, again, exclude other liver diseases. So talk with them about, you know, what is their history? What is their medical history? I'm always asking about other autoimmune diseases or a family history of autoimmune disease. Sometimes I'll, you know, specifically say lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, just to kind of let them understand what I'm looking for. This is less than 40 grams a day, actually, alcohol consumption. Liver biopsy is the definitive method of diagnosis for this, but it's not indicated in asymptomatic people who do not have elevation of the AST or ALT. A lot of times I'll wait to see that the liver enzymes are elevated for 6 months, then I kind of will do the full chronic liver disease workup, looking for all other autoimmune diseases, genetic inherited diseases, and if after that period of time those are negative and they're unable to lose weight to maybe improve these labs, that's when we move to a liver biopsy. Sometimes that's my discussion I have with them when I first see them in the office. If you lose weight and we can see that these improve, you may not have to get a liver biopsy. Some people are like, here, I'll get out my calendar. When's my liver biopsy going to be? Because they know they're not going to lose weight. So, histologic findings, again, steatosis. It's macrovesicular. It's mild to severe. You're going to see some inflammation, hepatocyte injury, the focal necrosis and ballooning. The hepatocyte degeneration. So these people might have Mallory bodies. About 5 out of 12 people will have this. I know that that's something that we usually think we might see with alcohol, but can be seen in fatty liver as well. And then varying degrees of fibrosis. So here you can see kind of the ballooning of the cells. These little inclusions, those are the Mallory bodies. Over here, the ballooning, the inclusions. So management. The management here is truly directed at the underlying cause. So they need to lose weight, gradual weight loss, about 5% of the body weight to start. 5 to 10% is goal, depending on how much they have to lose. If they're diabetic or have high cholesterol, they have to get that under control. They need to exercise. They say 5 times per week, greater than 6 months. I tell my patients, work up a sweat, get your heart rate up. Start with 1 day a week so that you're not saying, I have to do 5 days a week and I can't do this, but the goal is 5 times a week. Again, alcohol use needs to be decreased. Abstinence if there's significant fibrosis. Make sure that these patients are vaccinated against hepatitis A and B because they are available and it's an increased risk there. And then, of course, avoid any other drugs that might promote steatohepatitis. These are things like, if you can, amiodarone or tamoxifen. At this point in time, you're not going to be tested on any of the newer medications that are still under review for the possibility of treatment for fatty liver. So viral hepatitis. Hepatitis B, risk in the United States, sexual promiscuity, IV drug use. A lot of times we'll see that the immigrants have contracted this at birth or in young childhood. I work in a university town. We have a large population that comes from the Asian countries to go to school. So I actually see a lot of hepatitis B in the patients that are, you know, coming just for the 4 years and treating that. Prevention, HBIG, so the immune globulin This should be given to people who have household and sexual contacts with patients with acute hepatitis B. And then infants and previously unvaccinated patients should receive the hepatitis B vaccine. So the serologic markers, I think when you don't see this all the time, it can sometimes be confusing. But the hepatitis B surface antigen, if that's positive, you have a current infection. The next one is the hepatitis B surface antibody. That means you either were exposed and you cleared the infection, or you've been vaccinated. Then you're looking at the anti-core antibody IgM. So this is a recent infection or occasionally a reactivation. And then you have the anti-core IgG, and that's a remote infection. And then when you're looking at the E antigen and or positive hepatitis B DNA, you have acute viral active replication. So, if you're looking at somebody that is acutely infected, again, hepatitis B surface antigen positive, anti-hep B core antibody positive, anti-hep B core IgM positive, and surface antibody negative. Somebody that's chronically infected, again, they're obviously going to be hep B surface antigen positive, hep B core antibody positive, the IgM is going to be negative, and the surface antibody negative. So when to treat? So if these patients are at increased risk for progression to cirrhosis, you definitely want to treat them. So you're looking at patients who have elevated liver enzymes, 2 times normal at least, active viral replication. So E antigen negative patients, this is when their DNA is greater than 2,000, or if they're E antigen positive, that's greater than 20,000. I don't know if it will get that specific or not, but those would be the 2 numbers to remember, E antigen negative versus positive. And then if you can identify active disease on a liver biopsy. So treatment for this, interferon used to be a big one, once weekly, and it had some better efficacy. Now we have some good oral agents, lamivudine, tenofovir, and entecavir. These have become more popular in the treatment of chronic hep B. A lot of these are also part of an HIV regimen, fewer side effects. Edofovir, that does have some nephrotoxicity. These can be useful in patients with decompensated cirrhosis. So question, 21-year-old presents to the ER with abdominal pain, fatigue, loss of appetite. He admits to IV heroin use and drinks about 2 to 3 beers a day. He has mild icterus, hepatomegaly, he has tender abdomen, and he's got some needle tracks. You're looking at his bilirubin, 5.6, AST and ALT are 950 and 1280. ELCFOS is 115 and albumin is 3.4. You're looking at his labs. His surface antigen is negative. His hepatitis B surface antibody is positive. Core is negative, IgM. Hepatitis A IgM is negative. And hepatitis C antibody, negative. What lab is most likely to make the diagnosis here? Is it the AMA and ANA, hepatitis C RNA, hep C RIBA, hepatitis B core IgG, or hep A total? So hep C RNA, these patients who are acutely contracting hepatitis C, their antibody may not be positive for up to 6 weeks. So we need to get the hepatitis C RNA in order to see if this is what's causing the elevation. They used to use RIBA, but they don't really use that any longer. We've kind of left that by the wayside. If you're getting a total of the hepatitis A, that's going to signal prior exposure. And same thing for the hepatitis B surface antibody. That's not going to give us the answer. That's a previous exposure or immunization. Hepatitis C is a leading indication for liver transplant, followed by alcohol, and very closely coming up to these is NASH. Diagnostic tests for this is the anti-hep C antibody. This does indicate a current infection or previous exposure with clearance. So some of these patients can clear hepatitis C, but they'll remain hep C antibody positive. Same thing for those patients that we're treating with all these medications now. They're going to always remain hepatitis C antibody positive. The level of RNA does not necessarily correlate with the severity of the disease. In the United States, the most common genotype that we're going to see is one. There's one through six. Certain, obviously, other areas of the world have different genotypes, but of course, with people moving around the world now, we're seeing more frequently genotypes other than one in the United States. So CDC recommendations, this is something you guys are all probably doing before the patients even get to us, which is why we get the consults. The adults born from 1945 through 1965 should be tested once without prior HCV known risk factors. So some of the risk factors we see are, have they ever currently or ever injected drugs? The other thing I will ask people is if they've had intranasal cocaine use, because that's also a risk factor. Do they have certain medical conditions that might expose them to hepatitis C? So they maybe have a clotting, they have to receive clotting factor concentrates before 1987, long-term hemodialysis, looking for people who've had persistently abnormal ALT levels or who have an HIV infection. Maybe they were prior recipients of a transfusion or organ transplant. These people might have been notified after when someone tested positive for hepatitis C who donated blood. Transfusion of blood or blood components or an organ transplant before July of 1992. So that's prior to when they really started checking blood for hepatitis C. So testing based on, you know, recognized exposure is recommended. So if you're a healthcare employer like ourselves, emergency medical and public safety workers after a needle stick, sharps or mucosal exposure to hepatitis C positive blood. Also, women who have children, those children have possibility of being exposed and they should be tested as well. So you have a 56-year-old male. He presents to his primary for an annual physical. He's in good health, but is found to have an ALT of 86. Skin rash diagnosed by a dermatologist as porphyria cutanea tarda. The PCP should order which of the following blood tests to help explain the findings? So is this hepatitis A, IgM, hep B surface antibody, hep C antibody, or hep E antibody? Hep C, so this is associated with porphyria cutanea tarda, has a number of dermatological findings. Once you treat hepatitis C, that frequently results in resolution of the skin findings. So subgroup of patients that might be more likely to progress to chronic liver disease depends on the duration of the infection, alcohol intake greater than 50 grams a day, co-infection again with HIV or hep B, male sex. The patients who are more likely to have cirrhosis have had a hepatitis C positive for greater than 20 years usually. A lot of times we'll see people that just had no idea, maybe they haven't gotten health care or they just didn't have elevation of their liver enzymes and they come to us with cirrhosis. So you have a 19-year-old college student, presents with 8 days of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and fatigue. She recently returned from a two-week mission trip to Haiti. She has a low-grade fever, tender hepatomegaly, and mild scleral icterus. Looking at her labs, she has a bilirubin of 4.9, AST of 1280, ALT 1980, ELCFAS 99, INR 0.9. When you're looking at her, which of the following lab tests is most likely to reveal the diagnosis? Hepatitis A IgM, Hep A total, CMV stool PCR, Hep B surface antibody, or hepatitis C antibody. So this person, you want to check the Hep A IgM. She presents with an acute hepatitis. She recently traveled to an endemic area. Hep A total only really reveals a prior infection and immunity. CMV is unlikely in this patient because she doesn't really have a history of immunosuppression. Surface antibody for hepatitis B describes immunity rather than an acute infection. And given her age, although you can't say for sure, but she was likely vaccinated as a baby. And she doesn't really have any clear risk factors for hepatitis C exposure. Hepatitis D, not too much to say about this other than you're only going to have hepatitis D if you have hepatitis B. It has to co-infect with hepatitis B. So you're never going to have just a hepatitis D infection without hepatitis B. Hepatitis E, this is a single-stranded RNA virus. The highest incidence of this is in Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Central America. It's the second most common cause of sporadic hepatitis in North Africa and the Middle East. It's spread by the fecal-oral route via contaminated water in these endemic areas. Person-to-person transmission is uncommon. It can be transmitted by blood transfusion, particularly in these endemic areas. So moving on to cirrhosis and some complications. Portal hypertension, this is an increase in the hepatic venous pressure gradient. In cirrhosis, it occurs through an increase in resistance to the portal venous outflow. So you'll get some distortion to the liver. 30% of the increase is thought to be potentially reversible vascular factors, and this is what the pharmacotherapy targets. Esophageal varices, another nemesis in the middle of the night. Risk factors for esophageal hemorrhage from varices is the radius of the varix, thickness of the varix wall, the pressure gradient between the varix and the esophageal lumen. People who have alcoholic liver disease, alcohol will really increase the pressure and make them more likely to have bleeding varices. So if someone was otherwise controlled, not drinking, and all of a sudden they start drinking again, they might have an increased risk for having a bleed. So the treatment, primary prophylaxis, all patients with cirrhosis, first diagnosis or long-standing cirrhosis should be screened with an EGD. If there's not any varices, these people can have a repeat endoscopy in 2 to 3 years. The first-line therapy, non-selective beta blockers, propranolol or nadolol, you don't need to do this unless they have varices that you see, though. You don't just need to put somebody on this without seeing varices. And then second-line therapy, band ligation. If you have somebody that you can't put on a non-selective beta blocker, then you're going to use band ligation to treat their varices. Control of bleeding is best managed by endoscopic means. So if someone comes in actively bleeding, we're putting them on octreotide. We usually continue this for 72 hours. Second-line therapy is TIPS. So someone you cannot get under control from bleeding from their varix, you're going to send them for TIPS. Prevention of rebleeding. These people, after you've done band ligation, again, is with the non-selective beta blocker, about 80% of people who have bled from varices will rebleed within 2 years. Sometimes they'll be decompensated enough that, you know, they're getting a liver transplant before that, but if not, then you need to watch them closely. I'm sorry, this is a blurry picture, but these are varix right here. These are some pretty, we like to say, juicy. There's a little red nipple sign there. You can see kind of the varix, a little red nipple. And that's what you're going after when you're banding. Sometimes it's just a lumen full of blood and you're not sure where you're going. So a 47-year-old female presents with a new onset of ascites and has developed over the last 4 months. She denies alcohol. She does smoke. She's obese but has no other medical problems. She admits to fatigue, decreased appetite, and some dyspnea. When you do a paracentesis, you notice that her SAG is 1.5, her ascites protein is 2.6, and the cell count is 101. Her serum albumin is 2.9. When you do an ultrasound, it's kind of limited due to her body habitus, but it does reveal that there's a patent portal and hepatic vein. So what is the next most appropriate diagnostic step in this patient? Do you want to do an XLAP, an echo, fluid analysis for cytology, or a triple phase CT scan of the liver? So answer is B, you want to do an echo in this patient. So their SAG is elevated, it's greater than 1.1. Differential in an elevated SAG is that you have cirrhosis, you have CHF, pericardial disease, Budd Chiari, veno-occlusive disease. But you look at her protein and it's mildly elevated, and this necessitates a cardiac workup. So pathogenesis of this is kind of nitty gritty, but renal retention of sodium and movement of the extra fluid into the peritoneal space. Diagnostic paracentesis is essential for patients who present with ascites. So if you have a cirrhotic that's never had ascites before and now they have new onset ascites, they should have a paracentesis. Or if someone comes in, you don't know what their liver status is, but they have ascites, you should check. Cell count of more than 250, that's when we're thinking about SBP. So management of ascites, they need to be on a low sodium diet. This is the very first step. And this is an important step that people always say to me, oh, I don't add salt to any of my food, but they eat cheese and hot dogs and fast food and everything frozen in their freezer, and they have no idea how much salt they're getting in. So that is a struggle to talk with them about. Fluid restriction, you don't need to fluid restrict these people unless their serum sodium is low, so it's less than 125. Otherwise, that's not going to change. It's more the salt. So diuretic therapy, you know, we're usually using Lasix and aldactone. This talks about the urinary sodium excretion used for determining the efficacy of therapy. I can tell you, I don't really do this. We usually will kind of do it based off the clinical picture. But if you're looking at it, the urinary sodium excretion more than 30, you use spironolactone alone. Sodium excretion between 10 to 30, you can use the combination of Lasix and spironolactone. Or if it's less than 10, then large volume paracentesis is usually required. So SBP, these people can be pretty sick. So end-stage liver disease, there's not a secondary source. And what I mean by that is they don't have a perf diverticulum or something like that that's causing them to have a bacterial peritonitis in the abdomen. Clinical manifestations, these people are going to be febrile, quite a bit of abdominal pain, tenderness. Sometimes it's not extensive, but sometimes these people are in quite a significant amount of pain. They may have altered mental status. Your index of suspicion needs to be high in these people. So you're looking at a positive bacterial culture. We don't always get that because sometimes we'll have a high index of suspicion. We'll take a tap and evaluate their PMNs, see that they're greater than 250. We start them on antibiotics before we're waiting for a positive bacterial culture to start them on antibiotics. Hepatic encephalopathy. Pathogenesis, these people, elevated ammonia and manganese, the one that we always talk about is the ammonia. These are considered the etiologic factors for encephalopathy. It can range from zero, basically nothing overt that you're really seeing, to the patients in a coma. Some of the basic signs that you might see in the very beginning is they have alteration of their sleep-wake cycle, forgetful, things that people often just chalk up to, you know, normal life, they're tired. Precipitating factors, GI bleed, infection, large protein meal, that's kind of lower on the list there, use of sedatives, electrolyte abnormalities or hypoxia, constipation, and hypoglycemia. So they talk about dietary limiting protein. You know, this might be on boards, but do we do it daily? Not necessarily. They say that depending on the level of encephalopathy, 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilogram per day. Long-term restriction of dietary protein, less than 1 gram per kilogram a day, should really be avoided in these people. Lactulose is the tried and true long-standing medication. Nobody really likes it. It doesn't taste good. It makes them gassy, and they all like to complain about that. I don't blame them. But it does help to remove the endogenous ammonia. And they should have 2 to 3 semi-form stools per day. The newer things that we're using, newer in the last probably 5 years, I feel like they've really been covered, the Xifaxan. That's kind of been a game changer, and I think insurance companies are starting to cover it more. But also the older stuff, they talk about neomycin and metronidazole. So some of the other chronic liver diseases. So you have a 46-year-old asymptomatic male. He has a brother with hemochromatosis. On exam, everything looks pretty normal. He admits to 2 beers a day. When you look at his labs, he has an iron of 180, transferrin saturation of 88. His ferritin is 1,200. When you look at his CBC, everything actually looks pretty normal. He has an AST of 52 and a normal-looking ultrasound. So we do the HFE gene testing. He's positive homozygous for C282Y mutation. What's the most appropriate next step in this patient? Do you want to do a liver biopsy, therapeutic phlebotomy, stop alcohol and repeat iron studies in a year, or an MRI of the liver? So this guy actually gets a liver biopsy. So there's a couple reasons for that. So if you have a ferritin less than 1,000 and a normal AST, you can just go straight to phlebotomy. But if you see somebody with a ferritin greater than 1,000 and or an elevated AST, this is when you're doing a liver biopsy and then phlebotomy. If you have a normal ferritin, they say you can repeat every 2 to 3 years. I usually do a little more frequently than that if they're homozygous for the mutation. Autosomal recessive disorder with increased intestinal absorption of iron. So when this is increased in the absorption, it then deposits into the liver, the pancreas, and other organs. And it's actually about one in every 250 Caucasian people in the U.S. are homozygous for this mutation. So it needs to be suspected in patients that do have an elevated iron saturation, ferritin, or family history. Most of these patients are asymptomatic. It can cause cirrhosis, heart failure, hypogonadism, and arthritis. That's in the second and third metacarpals. HFE gene mutation is autosomal recessive disease. So 85% of these people are homozygous for the C282Y mutation. So treatment in these people, it's reserved with evidence of iron overload. So this is indicated by an increase in the serum concentration of ferritin. You're doing a therapeutic phlebotomy. It's pretty simple, relatively inexpensive, and it's very effective. Obviously avoiding iron supplements in these people. You want to avoid raw fish due to the risk of Vibrio, and also avoid alcohol. If it's diagnosed and treated before diabetes and cirrhosis develop, this survival rate is actually quite normal. But that's also why it's very important to treat so you don't develop that. So 18-year-old male is seen for 6-month history of abnormal liver test. He's pretty asymptomatic. He's been poor performing in school and has ADD. He's mildly obese. He doesn't really have any stigmata of chronic liver disease. When you look at his labs, he has an AST of 65. He has a bilirubin of 1.2, ALT 87, ELK-FOS 120. You do a hepatitis panel, viral hepatitis panel, it's negative. ANA is negative. You check a ceruloplasm, and it's just low at 19.2. When you do an eye exam, that's negative. And then you check a 24-hour urine copper, and that's elevated at greater than 40. Biopsy does show mild steatosis and minimal inflammation and a copper weight of greater than 250 micrograms per gram. What's the most likely diagnosis here? Is this PBC, Wilson's, drug-induced liver disease, autoimmune liver disease, or fatty liver? This is always asked, Wilson's disease. So this is an inherited disorder. It is a disorder of excess copper. It has manifestations that are hepatic, neurologic, and psychiatric. The gene mutation that you're going to see for this is the ATP7B gene. It's across all ethnic groups, and it's about 1 in 30,000. So pretty uncommon. So you're going to see a reduction in ceruloplasm. And what I can tell you about that is that ceruloplasm can be reduced in people who have a mild malnutrition. So you have to check the urinary copper excretion. Presence of Kaiser Fleischer rings, it's pretty rare that you find these, but they definitely can be found. Elevated hepatic copper level on biopsy. And then the patients who are coming in maybe in a Wilson's crisis, they're going to have a Coombs negative intravascular hemolysis. And they also have a low level of ELK-FOS. So that's a good kind of light bulb there if they have a hemolysis and a low ELK-FOS and elevated liver enzymes. So the treatment with this is copper chelation. So the D-penicillamine, triantine, and zinc. Sometimes when these people are started on chelation therapy, they can actually have neurologic decompensation. So you have to be really careful about that. So there's the classic Kaiser Fleischer ring. It can only be seen with a slit lamp. So you have a 16-year-old. They present with an AST and an ALT elevation for the last 4 months. Originally, this was thought to be due to mono, due to fatigue and low-grade fever. But they checked a mono spot, and it was negative. When you look at the physical exam, it's pretty negative for stigmata of chronic liver disease. The labs show an AST of 356, ALT of 435. You have a T-bili that's 1.1, PT 13.2. They do a viral hepatitis panel, which is negative. ANA is 1 to 640, and the anti-smooth muscle antibody is 1 to 320. They did an AMA, which was normal, and the liver biopsy shows cirrhosis with increased lymphoplasmacytes. What do you think the diagnosis is here? Do we have an autoimmune hepatitis? a primary biliary cholangitis, which used to be primary biliary cirrhosis, Wilson's disease, acute viral hepatitis, or primary sclerosing cholangitis. So this is autoimmune hepatitis. So this occurs in children and adults, more commonly in females, 3.6 to 1 ratio there, and across all ethnic groups. Clinical manifestations, these people can be subclinical, or they can come in and complete liver failure. They can also present with cirrhosis. That this patient in this clinical scenario, 16 years old, has cirrhosis. So you're looking for diagnosis, you're looking at their liver enzymes, ANA and anti-smooth muscle antibody positivity. They're not always positive. Hypergammaglobulinemia, when you're looking at histology, portal mononuclear cell infiltration, lymphoplasmacytic infiltrate, and fibrosis can be seen. Treatment, if you have somebody that comes in with an acute autoimmune hepatitis and you can't treat them with steroids, they may need a liver transplant if they can get one. If they're, you know, mild case, not coming in, needing a transplant, prednisone and azathioprine, these are the long-term treatments for these patients. A lot of times you can't get them off of it. You may try and take them off the medication and their liver enzymes rise and they have inflammation again. So when you're looking at these patients, you're going to see an increased AST, ALT, again, the gammaglobulin, mild hyperbilirubinemia, but it's usually less than 3. You can see an ELK-FAS elevation in these patients, but it's usually less than 2 times the upper limits of normal. And then you're looking at the ANA, anti-smooth muscle antibody, the anti-LKM1, that's more commonly seen in the European population. So primary biliary cholangitis. So this one's more of a cholestatic liver disease. About 90% of these patients are women, and 95% of them will be AMA positive. So fatigue is very common in these people. A lot of times it's late presenting because they've just dealt with the fatigue for many years. Pruritus, about 30 to 50% of people, because this is a cholestatic disease. And again, frequently picked up in asymptomatic patients due to lab abnormalities. Sometimes the IgM can be high as well. So alpha-1 antitrypsin, don't see it too often, but autosomal cold dominant disorder with the liver and the lung. It can cause premature emphysema and liver disease. Patients with cirrhosis due to alpha-1 antitrypsin actually have a significantly increased risk of HCC, hepatocellular carcinoma, up to 30% if they have cirrhosis from it. Diagnosed by phenotyping, the liver damage doesn't correlate with the level of alpha-1 antitrypsin, unlike in the lung. Diagnosis is confirmed with biopsy. Unfortunately, there really isn't medical treatment for the liver manifestations of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency.